Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and the nation is remembering one of the country's leaders for racial justice and the civil rights movement. MLK is widely recognized for his nonviolent approach, but some historians say his legacy has been, in some ways, sanitized over the years, with more controversial aspects of his advocacy sometimes overlooked or ignored. He was disliked by much of the U.S. population during his lifetime, according to contemporary surveys. He was considered a radical by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, who targeted and monitored him prior to his assassination. King also stood firmly against the Vietnam War and imperialism and advocated for radical changes to American society to create equality.
One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring.
On the federal holiday in his name, we're digging deeper into Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy and the theology behind his activism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What comes to mind when you think of Martin Luther King Jr.? What parts of his legacy stand out to you? Do you worry that his message gets oversimplified? What questions do you have about King's activism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Leonard C. McInnis II is an assistant professor of African-American religions and black studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's co-chair of the Theology of Martin Luther King Jr. Unit of the American Academy of Religion. He's the author of the book, The Black Coptic Church, Race and Imagination in a New Religion. Leonard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Very glad to be with you.
I think the quick view of Martin Luther King's legacy that people might have is, okay, nonviolence, sure, civil rights, the I Have a Dream speech. Do you worry that there's a lot more that we kind of lose in the shuffle as we look back today?
Indeed. You know, oftentimes it's my suspicion that the king that celebrated in January is one of a sanitized or this safe king that we've somehow constructed, right, in the imagination of a world and culture that often prefers peace over rebellion or silence over critique and order over disruption. But my fear is that this king that we've created, this docile figurine, who actually stands in contradistinction to the radical imagination that foregrounded very much who King was. And so for me, this January king that we celebrate is in place to perform this sort of cleansing, if you will, of the conscience from the recognition that our nation's beloved son was once America's most hated Negro at the time of his death.
I want to talk about that point a little more, because I think nowadays people refer to Martin Luther King as, you know, the right way to do activism and somebody that everybody could rally around, in contrast to whatever activism we might see today. That very much wasn't the view of Dr. King before his death in the 60s. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that the king that we imagine, right, is this king that gave this I Have a Dream speech while neglecting what came before the speech, right? But also neglecting the different parts of his life that were interrogated, right, by Hoover and the FBI. More specifically, the apex of this happens, obviously, at Riverside Church in New York, right, when King was openly questioning and critiquing the nation for its involvement in civil war by making this comparison between a nation that was sending young black boys to Vietnam to fight who could not return home to things like good schools or a housing market that was open to them or an economic system that had largely pushed these individuals to the margins of our society. And so this king that we've constructed does not really align with this radical, again, who Hoover thought would one day become the messiah, if you will, of black nationalism. And so for me, it's important to bear in mind that King's imagination was certainly one that called for, you know, racial equality and justice in the world, but he was also this radical, or this person that I like to call a rebel, who were voted against systems, be they economic, social, political, religious, or theological, that called into question the very dignity of the human subject. And so for me, any right interrogation of King must take into consideration the ways in which King calls us to be a radical for change, to be a radical, I would say, even for revolution, for calling into question economic systems where there are have and have nots, or societies in which young men can go to war, as he thought in his day, and fight alongside, you know, their white brethren. But when they returned home, they returned to the slums of Detroit and the slums of Chicago and these other socially constructed ghettos that tried to manipulate their existence. And so it's important, I think, as you all are asking us to do today, to pull back the layers of King and beg the question, what in fact does it really mean to honor the legacy of this individual who not only called for a world in which, you know, black kids and white kids could grow up together, but actually called on his government to perform and do better in the face of a hostile situation that, again, called into question the complete dignity of all people?
I want to peel back one particular layer, Dr. King's theology. Can you talk about how his theology, his Christian background as a minister, yeah, informed some of these more what were viewed as radical ideas at the time?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I am a student of religion and theology, more specifically, a student of the Black Church, right? And, you know, whenever I teach King to undergrads, I often say, you know, King did not need, you know, Morehouse College or Boston University or Crozier Theological Seminary, those places that educated him, to understand that God was a God of justice. No, King learned these ideas about a just God and a God that demanded a world in which all people would be able to thrive and flourish from the two people he called Mama and Daddy King, right? He's talking about his parents, who instilled in him a particular kind of theology that we might suggest was a theology of liberation. And so we have to bear in mind that when you take King outside of his religious context and outside of his radical Black Baptist tradition, you actually miss who in fact King was. And so when I think about, you know, King, I like to remind my students that King himself sits in this radical tradition of this Black Baptist tradition, that is, that gave birth to individuals like, you know, Denmark Vesey and Martin Delaney, right? And all of these radical, you know, rebel rousers, if you will, who sought to transform the world using the gospel to do so. And so when King is reading the gospels and he's interpreting the life of Jesus, King is reading the scriptures from what we might call from below, or reading the scriptures from the position of the enslaved, of the subaltern, of the individual who does not have access to economic wealth and does not have access to riches. And so when King approaches the gospel, he's asking the question, what in fact is the meaning of this gospel to the most vulnerable, to the most weak, right, to the dejected and those so ostracized? It's that kind of position that gives King this orientation toward the Gospels, in which the fine line that he reads the Gospels is through the lens of justice, which in its Latin simply means to do that which is right. And so at the core of King's imagination is, in fact, this religious orientation that demands justice, that demands that one operate and work on behalf of the most vulnerable and the most weak and the most dejected. That, in fact, is the King who spoke at Riverside, and that is the King that Hoover would call the most hated or the most rebel-roused Negro in America.
We're talking to Leonard McInnis, professor of African-American religions and Black studies at the University of Illinois, about Martin Luther King Jr. and how his legacy can get sanitized, oversimplified. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as MLK's legacy? Why do you think certain parts of his advocacy and activism aren't as well remembered? Do you think that his life, his career needs to be taught differently in schools? What do you remember learning about him growing up? Or what do you remember hearing about him if you were a contemporary? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Leonard McInnes. He's an assistant professor of African-American religions and Black studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's with us today to talk about Martin Luther King Jr. and the way his message can be misrepresented, distorted, or oversimplified. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pat is with us in River West in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, I'm 61. I grew up in a Catholic school for 8 years. I think we learned the basics of Martin Luther King, similar to Christopher Columbus. And then as we, you know, learn more and find out more of the, just the storybook, patriotic stories of these great, or these men, we find out, you know, Martin Luther King is a real person. You know, he's not a myth. And he had, you know, shortcomings as a man, it seems. But that's nothing that should scare us away from learning about him. You know, similar, like, hey, what a shock we're finding about Henry Ford. What a big Nazi lover he is. So, you know, let's learn more about these great people. And we could sift through whether they have good theories.
Pat, I got you. I want to jump in and bring in our guest, Leonard, the idea of talking about Martin Luther King, not just as a myth or even historical figure, but as a human in the midst of all of that.
Yeah, you know, this is important, right? I mean, I think, you know, part of creating this heroic narrative around any person of consequence in history is that we have a tendency in these kind of mythic, you know, creations to lose sight of the fact that these individuals were not, you know, just these heroic people, right? They were individuals and humans who made errors in their judgment and, you know, who oftentimes and sometimes did not, you know, present themselves in a public and a private way that often was, you know, were in equilibrium. King is no different, right? I mean, King was an individual who certainly presented himself as this prophetic individual, which he was, right? But he was also an individual who had personal, you know, problems, be it in his marriage, in his personal life. But I appreciate the way your caller cautioned us with saying that even with these revelations, right, that perhaps King, you know, was not always faithful, right, to his wife, where we know that, you know, King, you know, was someone who involved himself perhaps, you know, in different, you know, sexual, you know, escapades or whatever. This does not remove the fact that we are dealing with a person of consequence in history. In fact, what I like to sort of take away from this is that King, even in his human fragility, right, was an individual who I think represented the whole of the human person, one who can be, you know, deified, if you will, as this heroic or this hero of a movement, but who also had personal struggles, right? This sounds very much like human existence itself. And so my fear is that often when individuals, not your caller, call that to our attention, that we have a tendency to say, oh, I tell you, right? He was not the person we thought he was. That was Hoover's tactic. But I think it's important, my friends, to hold the whole of King in tension with each other, right? King, who he was as a personal individual, in tension with King, who he was as this very public pulpiteer proclaiming justice in the unjust world.
Thanks again for that call. I want to hear the voice of Dr. King a little bit more here. This is him talking about racism. This is in the final sermon he delivered at the Washington National Cathedral not long before his assassination in 1968.
Racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent fought America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism.
Leonard, as we talk in the current day about how we talk about racism or whether we talk about racism in schools, some of those statements I think would violate some state laws that have been passed over the last year or two. Your thoughts on that direct heads-on take on racism from Dr. King?
Yes, yes, yes. This is so important. You're right. In many ways, what King just articulated, I would argue, is what we might call a modern virtue of critical race theory. And I think you are absolutely right to suggest that the way in which King just talked about race would have him in trouble even more today than he was when he gave this speech in 1968. I think what King is trying to call to our attention is that racism is insidious, right? Racism is, it's cynical. And I think far too often, my friends, that we have this idea of racism as something that is covert, that is open, that we can always see. In other words, we know the Klan was racist because they wore the white sheets, and we knew by their demonstration that there was something about their perception of Black bodies that did not square well with the question of what it means to be a person of human decency. But racism, I think this is what King is getting at, oftentimes works a bit more insidious than this. What King is asking us to do is to consider how and in what way things like policy, performance of policy, the construction of neighborhoods, how we talk about things like the, you know, funding of schools, thus on and forth, how there are racist motives and policies that are intertwined in the very structure of our society. In other words, when James Cone, the father of Black theology, suggested that racism was America's original sin, what he was talking about was this Augustinian view in which sin permeates every generation of humans. That's this kind of this Christian theology of sin. Well, someone like James Cone and Martin King had a very similar view that unless we have the courage to attack and talk about racism, how it shows up, where it shows up, the way that it in fact denigrates the human person, denigrates human decency and integrity. For King, if we did not talk about that, racial capitalism, right? If we did not talk about the prison industrial complex, if we did not talk about redlining in certain communities, then we have missed the fact that racism is not merely someone saying, I do not like Black people because they are Black, but rather the way in which this insidious idea shows up structurally in the way that we organize and build the world in which we live. It was those kind of ideas and policies that someone like King was animated through his Christian radicalism to overturn.
Let's bring on another caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I'm old enough to have been eligible for the draft of the Vietnam War, and I remember that Dr. King was very much opposed to the Vietnam War, and it was when he started expressing these anti-military industrial complex and the war in Vietnam and all that, that, you know, maybe the FBI got a little bit more involved, and he, you know, Lyndon Johnson didn't like that he had this anti-Vietnam War view, and that's something that's forgotten now. They don't talk about his anti-war activism, and he was very involved in that. And the other thing I want to make one more comment is that the former president, Donald J. Trump, is a straight-up racist. He said that about immigration from Asia and Africa. He said that Nazis were good people. That's his whole appeal, is that he's appealing to people who feel resentment and hatred and all the things, and none of those will make America great.
I gotcha. We just have a couple minutes left. Leonard, Willem's point about anti-Vietnam War activism.
This is critical. What William is talking about is King's speech, A Time to Break the Silence, right? I mean, and he's right. King did not initially want to publicly oppose the war, right? He was silent in the beginning because he did not want to disrupt his relationship with Johnson and the government relationships that he had built. But at some point, King recognized that there was a real discrepancy in being silent for a war that was taking place abroad for someone else's freedom, when the freedom of all citizens in the country in which he lived was always at risk. And so King broke his silence precisely because he saw a contradiction in realities, that it was contradictory for our country to send young Black boys over to Vietnam. When they returned, as I said earlier, from that war, they could not live next to the people they were fighting alongside. They could not live in the neighborhood that was decent or have access to loans to get homes and thus so and forth. So, and he's right. When King made that speech, that's exactly when someone like Coover would suggest the King had been influenced by the Communist Party and he was a threat to democracy and freedom in America. And he, as I know our time is getting away from us, he, after that speech, would again be labeled as a public enemy and would be the target of brand new COINTEL efforts by the FBI, precisely because of the speech, A Time to Break the Silence Around Vietnam.
Willem, thanks for that call. And Leonard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leonard C. McInnes II is an assistant professor of African American religions and Black studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He was with us today to talk about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as the nation marks his life and legacy today, and what we can lose when it gets oversimplified or sanitized as we retell and teach the story of Martin Luther King.